Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here on the program with us once again, David Desser. He's professor and director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at the University of Illinois. And every once in a while, he's here on the program. We talk about movies and do several sorts of things to talk a little bit about current films. And certainly, you are welcome to call in and tell us about the movies that you've been watching lately. Maybe there's one that you would like to recommend. You'd say, this is a great movie. I'd say, go out and see it. Or maybe there's a movie that you thought that was just terrible, and you'd say, don't waste your money. You can do that. We can also talk a little bit about trends in the business, about what goes into movie making. Just a couple of weeks from now, the Academy Awards will be handed out, and we talk perhaps a little bit about some of the movies and the performers that have been nominated and who might win and who cares. And also, I thought we could spend a little time talking about the writer's strike, which has been going on now for 3 months. And any and all of that, if you have questions on those sorts of things, you can give us a call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. And Dave's talking with us this morning on the telephone. How you doing, Dave?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for spending some time with us, as always.
No problem. My pleasure.
Well, I thought it might just be interesting to talk a little bit about the writer strike. It's been going on now for 3 months, and there apparently is some indication that maybe it might be close to being settled. At least the stories that I have read suggest that the people who are negotiating on behalf of the writers with the producers have something, and they want to try to run that by the membership this weekend. So I guess it's possible that we might soon have a settlement. And, of course, one of the things that I think everybody's looking at is the Academy Awards. They'd like to have this settled so that the ceremony can go ahead.
Right.
And we've already seen some big things. I guess the last big thing really that was the ceremony that was scuttled by the strike was the Golden Globes.
Yes, it was. Yeah, what they want to do on Saturday is they want to have a meeting out in L.A., and tell the writers where things are at and suggest that they go back to work, and then they'll hammer out the final details, and then over the next few weeks it'll take a while to, for the writers to vote on it. But apparently the chief negotiators and the heads of the East and West Writers Guild branches are pretty well liked, and so whatever they say, the 12,000 writers will agree upon. So if they they look like they have a preliminary agreement on Saturday, they'll tell them to sort of get back to work, and I think the high priority will indeed be the Academy Awards. That would have been a disaster if they had picketed that and no actors showed up.
Yeah.
Because the Golden Globes was a disaster, that's for sure.
That was something that I didn't really take too much notice of, that other than read the few stories about it, that essentially what had been this big, typical Hollywood sort of glitzy event where everybody got dressed up and you got to see the stars walk down the red carpet and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
And that basically it turned into a press conference, and that was a great disappointment for probably a lot of people out there.
Well, I actually watched it because, there's nothing else on TV.
Because there's a writer's strike.
Exactly. So I actually watched it, and it was like worse than a press conference because the two hosts tried to be sort of chatty. And what they should have done, of course, was with that opportunity, is they should have showed more clips from the films.
Mm-hmm.
The people watch the ceremony to see the stars, and they come up and give their little speech, and it's very cool. I don't really know that people care who win necessarily, but in this instance, what at least they could have done is, if they couldn't see the stars, they could have seen the films and TV shows that the stars were in. So they handled the clips business very poorly, and then of course the hosts weren't very good, and so it was really it was pretty bad.
What's I suppose what some people will find remarkable is that these award shows, where the stars come out and they stand there at the podium and they make sometimes a kind of lame attempts at being humor, that stuff that they're saying has actually been written. Somebody has written that.
Yeah, the when they come out to be presenters and they have the comic byplay. they're clearly reading that. You would think that actors could memorize a few sentences. all that's written, and most of the monologue is written. There's the occasional off-the-cuff thing, but You know, I also have to remember all of the tributes and you know, those kinds of special things are also written. So it's not just a byplay, but you know, I would say 2/3 of the show itself is scripted, even including the you know, the actors who accept the things. Those are their own words. Mm. Although they sometimes hire writers too. But there's a whole, maybe about a dozen people who are like regular contributors to the Oscars, and you know, they'll write jokes and things like that. And so, as some of the talk shows have indicated earlier on, when there's no writers, it's really not very, it's not very entertaining.
That's an interesting case here, particularly for shows like Leno and Letterman and the guys who run Comedy Network, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, and Conan, those guys. Letterman worked out a deal with the writers, so his writers actually came back to mm-hmm. work. The other shows, they're not working with writers, but they're actually members of the guild themselves, so technically they're not even supposed to be writing for themselves.
That's true. I'm not sure. I actually haven't been watching... so I don't know how if it's lame or not, but that is true. Maybe they get a waiver, and it's another thing. Of course, is I don't think that the writers are actually picketing their shows, because they would not only be members of the Writers Guild, but they might be a member of one or another of the Actors Guild. Jon Stewart is probably a member of the Screen Actors Guild because he's actually been in a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. So if they were picketing his show as a SAG member, he shouldn't cross the picket line, let alone write anything as a WGA member.
Yeah, and I think probably Colbert is also in SAG because he's been in some movies and has acted on television too. So
you're probably right. So I don't know the details of how that works, but obviously they, you know, unless they guarantee that I will say nothing except what comes to my mind when I'm on the show.
Completely extemporaneous. Well, that's hard to believe that's actually what's going on.
Yeah.
Well, the strike now has been going on for 3 months, and it's more obvious or perhaps more noticeable in television, maybe because their production timelines are a little shorter. When would you expect, or would you really expect, at some point to see the impact of the writer's strike on motion pictures?
That's a good question. I think a number of films have been pushed back. When a film is announced, it's often cast and has everything in place, but script revisions are often still going on, sometimes even when they're shooting. So a number of films that may have been announced to start shooting will have to postpone. I don't know of any specific examples offhand, unfortunately, but I don't know that you'll see anything. It takes such a long time, and movies are in the pipeline. But certainly I think a number of big films that might have been announced for next year will have to be pushed back unless the script can really be whipped into shape. I suspect that some things probably were not announced, you know, some negotiations for things. I mean, generally it takes... from the time somebody has finished the script and someone says, yeah, I'm going to make it still takes 2 to 3 years to get it in front of the cameras. Hmm. So the whole process is kind of mysterious, but I suspect there are a number of films that have had to have been delayed or pushed back, certainly.
So, and that's 2 to 3 years before you start shooting. That doesn't account for how much time it takes to actually make the movie and edit the movie and all that.
Yeah, a big budget movie, you know, from the time they start shooting to the time it's finished takes anywhere from a year to 18 months. And they're very careful. They're really very careful these days, of course, as to when they're going to distribute it. And some movies that are finished have been held back for a long time. It's really very complicated. But I mean, it's a miracle if you write a script and then say someone says, "Well, I want to buy it," and then they put it into production. If it takes less than 18 months, it's really a miracle.
Mm. Our guest,
for a bigger movie, independent movies can, it all depends.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Dasser. He's professor of cinema studies at U of I. He's, in fact, the director of the unit for cinema studies and has been here on the program before many times to talk about movies and how they're made and how they're sometimes unmade. If you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here over in Belgium. And it's line number 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the writer's strike, and I'd like you to explain to me why I should feel sympathetic to the writers when their average salary is over $100,000 a year. That's not like your typical individual who's involved in a labor dispute.
Well, this is one of the problems that I would have a couple of answers, but this is one of the problems that I think writers and maybe even actors more so because of some threatened labor issues with the Screen Actors Guild. And it's a real PR problem. One of the things is that there are 12,000 members of the Writers Guild, and I don't think that by any means all 12,000 are regularly working and are going to necessarily make as much money as we think. There's also times when individual writers, many of them, the vast majority of them, don't have any income. And what they have to count on. See, they're not asking for more money, to say if I sell you a script I want X more money, or if I do a rewrite I want X dollars. What they're striking about this time is residual payments for when their work is broadcast or sold or otherwise made available in formats that didn't exist. Essentially, the last time the writers renegotiated a contract. They renegotiate every 3 years, and they hadn't been on strike for almost 30 years. But it's as if you signed up as a carpenter, and they say, well, you're going to build this house, and then someone say, well, there's a house next door that I want you to build, but I'm only going to pay you 2 or 3% of what I paid you previously because, we have this contract that you work for me. And so it's not a matter of feeling sorry for them. It's a matter of what is their work worth. The other way to look at it is, should we feel sorry for the producers who make, in many ways, probably much more money than the writers, and who are going to be making more money by selling or making available the content that the writers have made? And they're going to make money on it, and they're going to get it, but the writers won't. So you could look at it in that respect of what's fair. What is your work worth? I look at it as in terms of an author, which I've published a number of books, and I make way less than $100,000 a year on my royalties. But let's say I signed up with a book publisher, and he offers me 6% for the first 1,000 copies. He offers me 7% for the next 1,000. And I say, fine. And all of a sudden he says, I'm going to make money on your book by making it available over the Internet, but I'm not going to pay you anything. People are going to read it and people are going to pay for it, but you're not going to make any money from it. But I am. And that's the way I look at the writer's strike. It's, what is your intellectual labor worth? If money is being made from it, shouldn't you profit to some extent when new availabilities are offered?
Well, I have a comment about that too. If we look at the Louvre is still making a lot of money because they have the Mona Lisa in it. But yet, Da Vinci's never going to get another penny for it, nor any of his relatives.
No, that's the same I don't know the rules about art, but Shakespeare is making a lot of money these days, but none of his relatives are. But if Shakespeare were still alive, or his relatives were alive 100 years after he'd written it, they would be making money every time a play was performed or rights were paid for it. So in that respect, questions of copyright really would apply. If Leonardo were alive today and there were rules about what do living artists or their heirs, are entitled to, they would have a lot of recourse, which is why in some ways they always say if you want to make money as an artist, you're better off being a dead artist. But for publishers and for writers and for creative people, these are issues of copyright. It would be the same thing. Look at it this way. If you bought a DVD of a movie that you liked, and you made copies of it, and you sold it to your friends, would that be fair to the people who made the movie, that you were profiting off something that all you were doing was essentially providing it to people and not giving the people who made it any kind of royalties? And I think that's what the issue is. And why is it that you are not allowed? Why can't you invite people to your house you know, and show a DVD and then charge them admission. Right? That's illegal. You can't copy it and sell it. You can't show it and charge admission. And so this is really what I think the issues are. If the producers are providing this content, getting some money for it, shouldn't the same kinds of rules apply? It's not that the writers are asking for anything that they haven't gotten before. It's that they're asking for something that's new. And the issue is not necessarily so simple. What the producers are saying is, you know, we don't know. We're not making any money off this stuff yet. We don't know how much money we're going to make. And so the writers, are, of course, you know, they're asking for percentages. And the producers are saying, you know, we can't quite afford it just yet. But that's where it gets tricky. And I can't say what kind of money is being made or isn't being made. But I can say that the issues are really what is your worth work, and if somebody profits from it down the road, shouldn't you, for a period of time, also profit from it?
Well, a lot of people have made a lot of money off of movies that never made any money. You know, I've always noticed that. You know, a lot of them never make any money, but sure live in a lot of nice houses, don't they?
Well, the you know, writers, directors, and actors are always claiming that the studios have a creative accounting. But there's a lot of money floating out there, and sometimes it is very hard to feel sorry for people who make a lot of money. But I would say that the writers overall are not the people we should take out our anger on. I think there's a lot of directors and a lot of actors and a lot of producers who are making more money than the vast, vast majority of writers. You can make a living. Don't get me wrong. You know, a successful writer makes more money than the rest of us, but there's a lot of people making more in the entertainment business.
Thank you very much.
Right.
Thank you.
Just, I think what the point here, what really makes this sort of interesting and difficult, and what people are arguing about, is the changing ways in which movies and television, for example, are made available.
Yes.
In the sense that there would have been a time when you'd say, well, where are you going to watch a television show? Where are you going to watch it on television? Or where are you going to watch a movie? You're going to watch that in the theater, and then maybe you're going to watch it on television. But now you can watch television. You know, now we have DVDs, and people are watching television programs on their iPods and on their, you know, who knows, they could be watching them on their Blackberries or on their cell phones or on their laptop computers, or there are all of these different sorts of ways now to make the programs available for people to watch that not all that long ago just didn't exist. So that's,
oh, no, that's right. And, you know, now people are savvy, but years ago, I mean, when I was in the pay TV world, if you tried to get an older film that had been independently produced, say, from the 1950s, it oftentimes was the question of who owns the rights to sell you the opportunity to show your movie on pay TV. Because when these contracts were struck, it was, I have the rights to distribute this movie in theaters, and I have this right to distribute this movie on television, but what is pay television? And what is VHS, and what is DVD, and what is streaming video? So nowadays they start to offer, you know, we have the rights to show this, you know, in perpetuity throughout the universe in any and all forms. But the question is, what will, you know, you may have the right, but what are you going to pay me for it? And so, you know, that's when it gets, nobody denies that the producers have the rights to show it, you know, streaming video or iTunes download, right? But you know, what are you going to pay me now that you have the rights for this kind of thing? So it really is very complicated. And these issues, you know, these kinds of issues for writers, directors, and actors, you know, when movies were sold initially to television, did you have, you know, residuals there? And in television, what happened when all of a sudden you started showing these things in repeats and when you started showing these things in syndication? So every time a new technology arises, you have to account for, you know, people deserve to be paid for their labor.
And I suppose as far as the writers are concerned, their position would have to be, if we back down on this one, then forever after we're lost. That whatever new thing comes along, we're lost. And so we've got to fight for, you know, every step of the way, we've got to say, fight for, okay, if we've got new platforms and new methods of distribution, darn it, you know, if you producers are going to make money, we deserve something. And
yeah,
if you give that up, you're lost.
Exactly. And I think the writers, initially one of the things that was occurring, it's kind of complicated. I'm not a labor lawyer or labor specialist. But I do remember when they renegotiated the DVD sales, the percentages were fairly small, and then a lot of writers felt that they didn't do a very good job of negotiating for that. So now they were going to try and put the DVD sales on the table in this strike. But one of the things is they took that off the table, but as you say correctly, they don't want to back down for these new technologies, you know, new delivery systems, so they really want to insist on what they think is a fair percentage. And they may revisit the DVD question down the road, although there's a lot of people who think DVDs will eventually bottom out and these new technologies will replace them, which is why they don't want to get caught short.
Our guest this morning, David Desser. He's professor of cinema studies at the U of I, director of the Unit for Cinema Studies. Very interested in film, obviously. Particularly as a scholar, he's interested in Asian cinema, especially the cinema of Japan, China, Korea, Asian America. And we've talked about some of those things in the past. But also when he's here on the program, we talk a little bit about movies and the films that are to be seen now on screens and other ways of distributing them, and we're coming up on the Academy Awards, so we have been talking here a little bit about the writer's strike and what that's all about and what that means for the business. But if you have other kinds of questions, you just want to talk about movies in other ways, or when we do these shows, I also always tell people, well, if you want to call in and tell us about something that you've seen lately, whether you thought it was a great movie or a terrible movie, you can do that as well. Any and all that is certainly fine. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Rantoul, line one.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for visiting.
Sure.
You touched on this earlier, which was the poor presentation by the actors at the Academy Awards. And I'm so curious and have never known anyone who could answer this question. They seem to spend so much money on every single thing, and I just wondered why they could not make the presentations better. I mean, I've known elementary school children who could, you know, make the dialogue more believable. it just seems out of balance with everything else. They're awarding people prizes for being excellent at their job, but then they read the teleprompter.
Right. That's right. Well, I said before, I didn't understand why most actors couldn't memorize their three lines of dialogue back and forth. But I actually don't know why they're so. The word I would use is lame. and I actually don't know why they are so lame, but, you know, it's a universal complaint. That with the, you know, $150 million they spend on an average Hollywood movie these days, and to showcase, you know, Hollywood at its best, why can't the ceremony itself be better?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure if you've been a regular watcher over the past couple of decades, you'll remember, you know, the terrible musical production numbers they used to do. I mean, some of them are still notoriously bad, you know. I really just don't know why. I can't say why the ceremony is kind of lame. I mean, I just think they should get up and say, you know, the nominees for Best Actor. My feeling has always been the biggest problem with the Academy Awards. And, you know, the funny thing with the Academy Awards is that each year it's eligible for an Emmy because it's a television show. But my feeling is it shouldn't be a television show, it should be a movie show. But I think they believe that people who watch the Academy Awards are not necessarily regular moviegoers. And so they try and make it like some kind of late-night talk fest kind of thing. And that's why I think it becomes sort of gabby. You'll notice that many times a lot of the presenters are young actors who have new movies out, or they're TV stars. They're just not the kind of, you know, gravitas that you might expect. My feeling is if you're going to celebrate movies and you want to advertise movies, show more clips, show more movies.
I agree with you. And this really, although all these years it has bothered me somewhat, it wasn't until I saw an award show on AMC. In fact, it was some sort of Lifetime Achievement Award for George Clooney. The presenters were absolutely excellent. Everything sounded like it was off the cuff. And so that kind of pushed me over the edge. But I do appreciate you answering my question.
All right.
My
well,
pleasure.
Thanks for the call. You know, sometimes I wonder when you see these people up there, the ones who are coming to present, I wonder, could it actually be that these people are nervous?
It could be that they're nervous. You often see, actually, the people who get the awards become very nervous.
Yeah.
But if you imagine that the billion people are watching, then you could be nervous. But yeah, it's possible.
Yeah, I would think that for those people have with as many public appearances as they've made and as many times as they've stood in front of a camera, that this wouldn't be different. But also, I suppose you have to consider just how nerve-wracking an experience it is to speak to a large group of people. So maybe if you're a big-time actor, it makes you just as nervous as it would make us.
It's possible. Possible, but that still might not explain the bad jokes.
Well, there's that. Yeah, there is that. There's no excuse. No excuse for that.
No, it's tricky. I really think that's a very good question to call or ask, but I really think it has to do with they really feel that they're doing a television show. They don't really feel that they're doing a movie show.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lifetime Achievement Award, although there are different groups that give that kind of thing, the classy one is the American Film Institute. And they really get, they really get the right people to present, and I think it is more relaxed. So the Oscars is just kind of the big show. Even, the Golden Globes generally, or typically, except for this year, are in some ways more free-flowing and just seem to be better than the Oscars, which I think want to be the biggest and the baddest and all that, and they end up being, maybe they're big, but they're just not very good.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Effingham on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks. I want to say first that power to the unions, which are dying. 12%, I think, of all American workers now are unionized, growing weaker. But that aside, my take on the writer's strike as being, I don't think it is elitist, but it's the most top of the rim for people who are in or attached to unions. And the long term that they are, as you've described, in the residues from their writing, goes a long ways toward the future. My question to you would be, if you have any idea about it, what is motivating management? Is the industry going to change radically, just like the analog and these other things that are coming to television, which has replaced the church as the pacifier for the masses? What future are they think they see, or how they're addressing that?
Well, that's a very good question, and I think one of the problems is that I used to make a joke about the movie business, having been on its fringes for a couple of years before I came out to the wonderful world of academia, and that is nobody in Hollywood knows what they're doing. And I think the thing that's driving a lot of this is actually television. The movie business is fairly stable. Budgets are so high that they're concerned for, they're certainly concerned about things, but the explosion in television programming and cable programming and satellites and the new technologies that will deliver audiovisual imagery has put them in a panic. And one of the sort of panics is also things like YouTube, in which people are watching other people sometime back, David will remember, we talked about this.
Mm-hmm.
And how can you make money off YouTube? And I said, you actually can't make very much money off YouTube unless you start charging people a penny or two every time they you know, take a download. So I think the producers, association that the Writers Guild has struck against, are really in something of a panic and trying to get in a holding pattern as to how much money are they going to give out at a time when it isn't clear how much money they'll make, where they'll make it from, what kind of content they'll be able to offer, what kind of money will be out there. There's just so much money is spent on other kinds of leisure activities, although, you know, the money that's spent on, let's call it entertainment, is still, you know, about $8 or $9 billion a year, but there's other things that occupy people's time. That I believe they're in a kind of, I don't know what the word to use, but like circling the wagons, just as the writers, as David pointed out, are kind of circling the wagons about we can't give in, but the producers were taking a fairly hard line. I mean, look at it this way. The writer strike has been devastating, especially to the larger economy of Southern California. There should have been no way that a writer strike lasted for 3 months. I mean, it's a disaster, but the issues, I think, are so unclear as to what the future holds. There was months they weren't even negotiating because I just think they felt they didn't know what to say or what to do, because they all have this fear of the future. And there's no way to know. I mean, no one 20 years ago could have imagined the kind of options that people have now, just even for watching movies. I like to joke that, you know, the thing that people want is the biggest screen they can get at home and the tiny screen they can get on their phone to watch the same thing. And these things are so confusing that they just don't know what the future is going to be. And, you know, years ago when I was in the film, on the margins of the film industry, I used to say that, well, it doesn't necessarily matter what the format is. People are always going to want to see stories in whatever format. So writers, directors, and actors are always going to be in demand. Now, that's true to a large extent, in which you have so many cable and satellite systems that are having new programming. But there's also programming that isn't being done by writers, directors, and actors, or even producers in the traditional sense, that who knows what's going to happen. We go back to Andy Warhol. Everyone will have their 15 minutes of fame. He may be more right than anyone ever thought.
Can I say one last thing,
sure.
David?
Sure.
Yes. What you've just described takes me back to the early Industrial Revolution in the early 19th century, where the laborers, you know, which was a new class, just as the writers, you know, they had their classification as well. But these early factory workers in England were ousted. They struck to get better working conditions, you know, the 20-hour days and all that sort of thing, and the terror of management. Meanwhile, management had looked ahead, built the housing for the workers, a lot of them Irish, too, and rented it to the workers. Well, when they struck, and the management let them live up their month's worth of rent, and in midwinter set them out upon top of the ground, and the strike went on. Well, those egregious things that happened then, you know, in my opinion, is a great deal of nuance now, just as you described, as the writer's strike being a disaster for the industry. But what were they to do?
Yes.
And so that's why I think the similarities of the situation, you know, over 100 years ago, and what it is now, 150 years ago, logically, nothing has changed. You know, we still have this battle between power and the powerless.
Yes, owners and workers. I mean, I agree. And what's interesting about that analogy although the first caller, I'm sure, wouldn't agree, but is the Writers Guild has traditionally been, I mean, this isn't necessarily a political strike, but when the Writers Guild was formed in its modern incarnation in the 30s, they were the most politically active, but also the ones that sort of led the way in imagining themselves as unions, which needed to look after their workers. I mean, they're not in this instance, unlike, say, you know, the Chicago or New York transit workers. Issues aren't things like health care benefits and things like that. But in fact, since writers, you know, nowadays they're all basically freelance. I mean, nobody is a contract to, you know, nobody works for Warner Brothers for their whole life and gets, you know, dental and medical and eyeglasses and all that. So they're all freelance. So how do they get you know, health care? And how do they get retirement benefits? Well, that's also what the unions do. Screen Actors Guild is probably fairly famous for this, but all of the unions have that sort of thing. So, although in this instance it's about, you know, residuals and payment for new delivery systems, the union still has this base in which it looks after its workers in the same kind of way that labor unions traditionally do.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Dave Desser is our guest. He's professor of cinema studies at University of Illinois, and occasionally he's here. We talk about movies and the movie business. We've talked a bit about the writer's strike, a little bit about the Academy Awards. Other movie kind of questions are welcome. In the time that remains, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And next we'll talk with someone in Urbana on line 2. Hello.
Yes, there will be blood. My husband and I saw that last weekend.
Oh, I thought you were talking about the writer's strike. Okay.
No. And it was really impressive. It is not something to see if you want something lighthearted and a comedy, but I think Daniel Day-Lewis is just amazing. He's on the screen most of the time. And he does a wonderful portrayal of this character, who is very hard to like.
Yes.
But it is just enthralling.
You know, I was interested. All the awards it's gotten.
Yes.
You know, the Screen Actors Guild,
yes,
which was a nice presentation on TV, by the way. All the awards it's gotten and all the nominations it's gotten really surprised me. Because I think that it snuck up on people. I mean, the director is not he's very well known, but he's not a sort of big-time mainstream director. He's basically known for independent-type films. Paul Thomas Anderson. Uh-huh. I think he's a great director. I think he's hugely talented. I don't like all his films, but he's really got a lot of style. But it's an independent movie. It's a very tough movie.
Yes.
You know, literally. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about the Academy Awards this year is that They gave nominations to the kind of movies that I think 20 years ago, and certainly in the olden days, they never would. These are really, you know, kind of violent and sort of tough, uncompromising films.
Yes.
And there will be blood. You know, when I first read about it, it was like Daniel Day-Lewis in some movie about oil.
Uh-huh.
You know,
It is hard to imagine.
Yeah, and I certainly didn't know if I wanted to see it or certainly I didn't know it would really be quite so, you know, its box office is respectable, but its critical acclaim is just unbelievable. I mean, I would say that's the most critically acclaimed movie of all. Initially, I would have thought that would have gone to No Country for Old Men.
Uh-huh.
But I think this has replaced it. I don't know what will win the Oscar for Best Picture, although that one has a good shot. But Daniel Day-Lewis, I think, is a shoo-in.
Well, I just think if people really are interested in a portrayal of a character, that it's not to be missed, because he, throughout the whole film, he really puts his all into being this person, and it is just so believable. I felt everyone did a good job.
It's an amazing achievement. It's just, as I say, it wouldn't seem to be the kind of movie that would. And again, you know, one of the problems this year with the Oscars is that there's no big commercial hit
mm-hmm.
that's even up for a Best Picture. That, you know, the kind of movie that certainly won't win, but it was a big hit. And this year, all the movies are really smaller, or you know, nothing's. I don't think. maybe one or two of them will break 100 million, but I'm not even sure that they will. So this is very unusual, and so again, I just think that There Will Be Blood is an incredible achievement. But the surprise is not how good it is, but how
well it's been
explained.
Yeah, the relationship of the main character with his son is so interesting. And in the beginning, we see him as other people see him, and he's a good salesman, and he says all the right things. And then as the movie goes on, we begin to see why he's saying these things and what he's really like. And so I felt that I was learning about him as the movie progressed. I did not like the ending at all. I just thought it was maybe something that was thrown on there to get the thing over. But, I just found it absorbing. And so if people don't mind something that really, it's electric, I think.
I think absorbing is a good word.
Yes.
I like that word.
Yes. So I just wanted to recommend that.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
And actually, I feel the same about No Country for Old Men. You can't take your eyes off of what's going on. What's my favorite thing for No Country for Old Men is I think it got some kind of, I have actually in front of me, is a, no, in some place it got a nomination for music, but not for the Oscar. But as people know, there is no music until the end credits. So that's kind of funny.
That's the kind of thing you would expect from the Coen brothers, you know.
Well, I'm just thinking to give that thing a nomination is very interesting, but the Oscars didn't. I just wanted to make sure that they didn't give it for
music. Best song from Old Country from No Country for Old Men. Let's talk with someone in Urbana here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, I have a question. And I come from a union family. My question was, when in the last 20 to 30 years has the Writers Guild supported, you know, the United Mine Workers, the UAW, the Teamsters, you know, the teacher unions? We've never heard from them.
You may be right, since I can't think of what they have.
And now it sounds like, you know, you're all asking for our support, and my question is, why?
Well, that's a good question. I think the issue there would be, you know, the writers probably could have. I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, I'd have to look that up, and I don't know what kind of support, you know, might they have given. Did they give money to the fund? Or, I mean, I don't know the answer. I'm of course not a member of the Writers Guild.
We're gonna come down this route a little further.
Yeah.
You know, the Writers Guild is in a very unique position. It has a commanding position where its voice can be heard very loudly when it chooses to.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, for the last 20 to 30 years, as the deunification of the United States occurred, they've been completely silent.
As I say, I don't know. You may be right. You may not be right. I do remember, in many instances, some of the Hollywood unions.
A few times they've gone out and they've.
Yes.
And some of the individuals have gone out and spoke about the teachers' union, but...
Oh, no, I mean, I remember a lot of... you may be right about individuals.
And I don't know if they were individuals or actually union representatives. I don't ever remember them coming out and doing anything for anybody else.
Well, I remember it could be individuals, and that, you know, they wouldn't be necessarily speaking for the union, but the United Mine Workers have gotten a lot of, let's say, public acknowledgement from Hollywood.
Well, did they ever go out in strike with anybody else?
That I don't know.
I mean, let's just call it where it is.
Yeah, don't know if they've actually joined a picket, but I do know that they have made public statements. And, you know, the Hollywood unions were very supportive. Again, I don't know about monetary, but certainly visibly publicly supportive of a lot of the migrant workers out in California.
Well, that may be true, but I say, in the last 20 or 30 years...
Yeah, that, you could very well be right.
Nothing's been done, as far as I can tell, and I'm really kind of an independent observer on this.
Yeah.
I don't have a dog in this fight, personally, but like I said, my family's been unioned, so I've always kind of... I understand the benefits that they provide, but as the unions are getting hit on health care and pension benefits... I haven't heard a lot from the Writers Guild on any of these issues.
No, you may very well be right, and they could very well have something to answer for there. Now, there have been, you know, on a different way, in the last few years, I can think, there have been movies about unions, and the importance of unions. There was that Charlize Theron movie that didn't do particularly very well, but there's a little more of a political filmmaking going on. So in that respect, you do have writers, directors, and actors who are, or at least in one or two instances, making films about union questions. You know what film I'm talking about, Dave?
I recall the movie. The thing is, I can't remember the name of the movie. I mean, I suppose if I took the time here, I could go to the Internet Movie Database and put in Charlize Theron, I could come up with the name of the movie.
So, you know, so in there's been some... attention in that respect about questions, but you know, I think Hollywood probably could, you know, well, they like to avoid politics overall, but you know, you may very well be right about the lack of, at least they could at least speak up more.
Just, we have a couple of minutes left. I just think I'd want to return just for a moment to the point you were making earlier about the movies that had been nominated either for the Best Picture or the Actor. I just think it's interesting that, and this is something that we've talked about before, when you look at the Academy Awards, it seems that from one year to the next, the Academy can't quite make up its mind as to whether it wants to honor artistic achievement or commercial potential. And they seem to sort of go back and forth. And this seems to be one of those years where, for whatever reason, they seem to have chosen to honor artistic achievement and not so much commercial potential, because I think a lot of the movies and performances that have been nominated are movies that haven't done huge box office and probably aren't really expected to do huge box office, but they are movies, a lot of them, that have gotten very, like the movies that we've mentioned, There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men and Michael Clayton and Juno, for example, movies that, well, actually Juno's done pretty well, I think, at the box office for a movie that didn't cost a lot to make.
No, it's done real well, and the more acclaim, the more nominations and award it gets, the better it does, which is why, you know, you want ceremonies like the Golden Globes and the Oscars to go forward. But I have a couple theories. One is that the commercial films, the big commercial films this year have been so average that they were made, you know, their box office was just made by marketing and sequels, and it's just, you know. But you could also say that the gap between the big hits and the artistic films may be getting larger. Second of all, I just don't think there was a kind of mid-level commercial film that just seemed so, you know, worthy of an award. You know, you just can't. You know, I don't have in front of me what were the, you know, top, say, 50 grossing films of the year, but I just can't think offhand of what was a big hit that you could also legitimately say might be worthy of an Oscar. Also, I think the Academy membership is getting a little younger. So, of course, you can't survey them and say, who did you vote for? But over the years, you know, membership's up to about 5,000 now. And I think that a lot of the people are... The other thing is, I think this maybe they've recognized that these smaller or independent films are just really good. You know, Juno is kind of like this year's Little Miss Sunshine, which also got an Oscar nomination back then. It's just... You can't ignore films that just seem really good. And Hollywood's a small town. I mean, people like the Coen brothers and Paul Thomas Anderson have a lot of respect. The Oscars also, the last thing I'll say, is the Oscars are really beginning to follow the critics. The critics, you know, the New York critics, the National Society of Film Critics, these kinds of critical awards that they give have really influenced the Oscars. I've noticed that in the last 10 years where... Every year there's at least one film that I can't believe would have gotten a nomination by the Oscars because it's so, you know, artsy. But the critics have really become influential for what the Oscars do.
Yeah. Just for the record, that movie we were trying to reach for with Charlize Theron, I believe that is North Country.
I was going to say North Country. I should go ahead and say what's on my mind. But, there have been a number of films like that, and films about the healthcare system that's come out in recent years. So it's Hollywood has done less than they could, but at least not nothing.
We are almost at the point where we're going to have to finish here. One of the things I like to try to do when you're here on the show is see if you have a couple of video picks or well, okay, I guess maybe now they're DVD picks. movies that have been shown in the theater now are available for people to rent that they might have missed first time around. You might say, well, you're thinking about renting something. You're going down to wherever it is you get your movies. Here's a couple that I might say, well, why don't you take a look at these?
I don't like to be obscure, but...
You, a professor of cinema studies?
I don't like to be a pretentious professor.
I know.
But a very interesting film that played commercially and is available routinely now on DVD, but is a Korean movie called The Host.
Hmm.
And it's a very interesting variation on the, sort of the Asian monster movie. But it's very funny and very interesting and has something to say. But I think if you want to see, a very strange, but a movie you will like, that's, not cheesy like Godzilla.
there's not wrong with Godzilla.
No, nothing wrong with Godzilla, but not quite so cheesy as that. Interesting special effects,
mm-hmm.
but a very interesting film. And if you've never sampled the Korean movie, The Host might be a way to go as an entry. So, but what I've been doing a lot on for my own video picks has been to catch up on television shows because I don't actually like commercials. So I've been watching lots of TV shows, and I'm into season one of Rescue Me.
Oh, and this is who is it? That guy who's the star.
Dennis Leary.
Dennis Leary, yeah. Oh, he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, no, so I'm getting, and I just finished the two seasons of a show that was on Showtime. That's a very interesting combination of comedy and drama, and it was a show called Dead Like Me.
Mm-hmm.
So my video picks are a Korean movie called The Host, and Rescue Me became controversial in recent years, so I'm starting from the beginning to see how it works up to the controversy.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that with the promise that one of these days Dave will come back and we'll talk some more. Thanks very much for being with us again.
You're welcome.
Dave Desser is professor and director of the Unit for Cinema Studies at University of Illinois.